From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Queens in a new library that finally opened after years of delays. Writing for the New York Times, Michael Kimmelman tells the story of the Hunters Point Community Library. It's set against a backdrop of what he calls dreary buildings, apartment towers, quiet streets, often ignored. But Kimmelman predicts that the new public library could change the entire feel of the area. He calls it one of the finest and most uplifting public spaces designed this century in New York. Every detail was carefully considered, and it's especially designed for kids to spend time, to learn, to read, to attend events. It's beautiful, but functional. It's for everyone. Kimmelman concludes that truly excellent architecture and design should bring beauty and access to all parts of American cities, not just the wealthy neighborhoods and downtown hubs. He writes, quote, "Cities deserve an engaged and mindful government that grasps the virtue of good design and what it can do for entire communities," end quote. Which brings us to Rochester and the Humanities Center at the University of Rochester. They're hosting a conversation titled Design Justice, Power and Place. They've invited Brian C. Lee Jr., the director of the New Orleans-based design justice nonprofit called Co-Locate. Brian's presentation aims to look at injustice in the built environment and what it means to dismantle the ecosystems of power that use architecture and design to entrench injustice. It's heavy stuff, but Brian is also a believer in the power of architecture and design to make change, to speak to the people it serves, all of them. And he challenges designers to be willing to serve the people who do not hold all the power. Our guests this hour include in studio Brian C. Lee Jr., design justice advocate and the director of the New Orleans-based design justice nonprofit, Co-Locate. Welcome, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Catherine Mariner, a professor in the University of Rochester's Anthropology Department and Visual and Cultural Studies Program. Catherine, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome back to Nana Yoando, who is Nana is an assistant professor of architecture at RIT and a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. Welcome back. Nice having you.
Thank you.
So today, 5:30 at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester, there is free parking, and this is a free event as we talk about design justice, power, and place. Brian, why don't you give us a little overview, and then we're going to kind of work through the various issues as it relates to your field here. But what do you want people to walk away with when they come see you today?
You know, I think ultimately we start with the fact that design justice really is about challenging those privilege and power structures that use architecture as a means to perpetuate injustice in the built environment. But it's also about how we look to forward racial, social, and cultural justice within the built environment. See, the physical spaces that we design and build and plan into our environment speak the language of our communities, and we all respond to them in various ways. And so what I want people to kind of walk away with is the idea that we have the power to shape the agency to shape our communities. And when we do that, our spaces, places, our politics will all be better for that.
And we're going to be specific this hour with Brian because he's done work obviously around the country. And if I could, I'm just going to read a little bit more of your resume so our listeners know who you are, because it's a long one. As I mentioned, Brian's the director of the New Orleans-based nonprofit Co-Locate. He's an architect and educator. He has led two award-winning youth design programs nationwide, founding organizer of the Design Justice Platform, was named one of the 2018 Fast Company Most Creative People in Business, and Co-Locate became the youngest firm to win the Architectural League's Emerging Voices Award. So that is quite a resume already for Brian, but we're going to be specific here. When we talk about sort of vague terms, we're going to try to distill and get away from the vagueness and get very specific mm-hmm. as to how these things have become entrenched and, frankly, how they can change. So let me just ask you where you would point to one place in the country that stands out in your mind. You say, look, this is where things are starting to change when I think of design and architecture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I live in New Orleans, so that's what I'm going to point you to. So one of the things that we've been doing more directly is bringing in design justice advocates into the design and planning process. What that leads us to is a particular project that we've been working on called the Claiborne Innovation District. Now, this project is a 19-block kind of marketplace that's seeking to restitch a community that had been torn apart because we sent highways through the oldest black neighborhood in in New Orleans. Now, this is a tree-lined street, 400 oak trees that were demolished, 396 businesses, 350 of them wiped away. Healthcare outcomes, economic outcomes, educational outcomes, all shifted because of this intrusion of a monstrosity of a highway that came through that environment. Now, the shift comes as we're starting to think about the ways in which communities and businesses specifically can actually operate within the context of this new condition of the Treme. And one just little note is that, you know, out of this community organizing effort, one of the things we pulled out was that 90% of the black and brown businesses in this particular community had 1 to 3 people throughout the entirety of their existence. What that means is that they can't get small business loans. They don't operate in the same fashion, which means we have to design spaces that actually operate for smaller, more familial conditions. And it allows them to actually operate better than they would if we had to shove them in spaces that they could not afford and would get pushed out of pretty quickly.
Building highways through neighborhoods is an American story in many cities, isn't it?
It sure is.
And here we are in Rochester, Nania, at least in terms of our community, we've filled 1/3 of the inner loop. I suspect we'll fill all of it eventually. There is talk about that already from city engineers and planners. But how much of the story that Brian is telling around the country do you think is reflected here in Rochester in terms of design equity and or maybe a lack of equity?
I think it's quite apropos because, again, the inner loop is something that was designed to separate Rochester. And we've come to the conclusion that that was a very bad idea, and we are now beginning to fill that in. And what I appreciate about the current process is it's been very inclusive, at least to my knowledge. And a few of the projects being built are actually supposedly affordable and low-income housing. So that shows that we are still trying to stitch together the community and trying to find a way to essentially remedy the ills of our past.
When you say affordable, though, that is a term that we hear a lot. Do you trust that word, and is that word applied too broadly?
I think it's applied too broadly because affordable is a relative term, right? Who can afford what? So what we need to do is remove all these labels that we place on buildings and determine who can actually be able to live here. And I think we often get an image in our mind when we talk about affordable housing, and it's often not too pretty, and we get an idea of who lives there, and it's people who are not like the majority, right? So what we need to do is we need to remove those labels and actually just simply design for people and look at who are the most vulnerable in society and give them a place to live.
Brian, you agree with that?
Yeah, so the question about affordability is really, the question about affordability is extremely important because it is a capitalistic term that actually starts to look at the average mean income. And oftentimes when we're thinking about development, affordability gets framed in this small little term, and it misses the directly and disproportionately impacted writ large. And so how do we, again, take expand upon what we mean by affordability, expand upon what we mean by housing, right? We don't necessarily, housing is one component of a larger set of conditions or functional needs that are necessary for an environment. So when we just say affordable housing, it misses all the other things that we need to survive. And so I think affordability has to be challenged at every move, as does everything else that we actually do in the development sphere.
We're talking at 5:30 today for this event, Design Justice, Power in Place, with Brian C. Lee Jr., one of our guests this hour. It's at the part of the ongoing series with the Humanity Center at the University of Rochester, and this event is at Rush Reese Library. 5:30 today. It is free. Parking is free. They'd love to see you there. Catherine, what are you looking forward to in terms of this kind of discussion here in Rochester?
I'm really interested in thinking about placemaking at a more micro level, perhaps, than sort of thinking citywide in terms of urban planning. I have a new ethnographic project that's looking specifically at how residents transform physical spaces in their neighborhoods. One of the ones that we've been thinking about a lot lately is a children's garden on North Clinton. So when we talk about the inner loop and we talk about sort of filling in the next section, which I think is going to be that northern section, it's really important to think about how that's going to help connect places like the neighborhoods along North Clinton, Joseph Avenue, back to downtown Rochester.
My very basic understanding of how the process works when you've got a situation where you're filling part of the inner loop, and again in Rochester, it's roughly the eastern third that's been filled. And watching that process play out, there was discussion about putting RFPs out and sort of submitting different bids and ideas on what could fill the space, what makes sense with compared to what's already there, but how to make it. Catherine, what stands out to you in terms of whether this process works or what it ought to look like, as opposed to just being driven by traditional power structures, money?
Yeah, I mean, I think something that's really important to the process is community input, and thinking about how to make opportunities for community input accessible to all kinds of people, right? So thinking about what times of day community input sessions are scheduled for, whether working people can make it to those, whether there's childcare available, whether they're accessible for differently abled people. I also think sort of what's really important is to think about, to go back to this question of affordability, right? So like a lot of the housing that's been developed on the eastern section, the measurement for affordability, there are different scales of affordability. So if we're using, for instance, the county mean income to determine affordability rather than the city, it's not going to be affordable for people that are living in the city, right? So I think that thinking in terms of scale, what we're using as the measures for these kinds of things is really important.
What is your read right now on Rochester in terms of equity of design, access, architecture? How does this community rate from your eyes so far?
I mean, so I'm just getting started. This is a new area for me. My sense is that there are a lot of people, very passionate people, very interested people in the community that are thinking about these things right now. Something that's really inspiring to me is that the Rochester 2034 plan is out now, and there's a whole placemaking plan. Like one of the first kind of chunks of that comprehensive plan is a placemaking plan. And so there's a lot of energy around this right now. At the same time, there are pretty egregious structural inequalities in this city, right? We have like really sort of poor health disparities. We have a lot of income inequality in the city. And so I think kind of harnessing a lot of the energy around design justice, around thinking about placemaking in a more broader, inclusive way, can really help kind of start to chip away at some of those inequities.
Brian, some of this I would think is built into decades, if not centuries, of power structures.
Indeed.
Which is that in our system, there are certain expectations for who gets in the room in decision making, whether it's planning, laying out community, making decisions about what's going to be built where. And as long as there is, and look, I mean, I'm not trying to make sort of an anti-capitalistic case. I'm just observing the power that comes from money. And as long as there is the current system in place, can you really expect to shake it up such that whether it's people in positions of power in government or design or the people the government hires for design are truly saying, look, you know who we're going to serve with this project? We're going to serve the people who are not in power because they deserve a voice and we deserve to sort of shake things up and reshuffle where the power of the emphasis goes. I mean, how does that actually happen?
It happens by a mass of people. We always talk about protest as a means to make social change, right? But when we define protest as an unyielding faith in the power of a just society. It is fundamentally and ultimately about hope, right? What can we envision for our future? And the only way to do that, specifically through design, is to make sure that there are enough people and enough human bodies in place to speak into existence their imagination, their creativity, and to claim physical space as a valuable part of their daily existence. And so I think what we have to do is make sure that our profession is stratified, so start internally, making sure that our structures, we always talk about the fact that, you know, if we think about pedagogy, policies, procedures, practice, projects, and people, so the way we teach people, the policies we make that account for the built environment, the way we practice and build things in the world, and then who are we connecting to, then we can actually understand understand the ecosystem of that system, or I'm sorry, the ecosystem of that of the development system, and then start to chip away at some of those barriers to access. One of the things that I always try to mention is the fact that if you think about doctors make up a small portion of the medical profession relative to the fact that there are a lot of nurses. Nurses are the people who actually are with patients on a consistent basis. We don't have that comparable in the architectural profession. We don't have those people who are on the ground every day in community making sure that the EKG is reading appropriately, right? But there are organizers. There are activists. There are people who are daily on the ground screaming about what issues are happening in communities. We should listen to them. We should incorporate them into our process, and we should make sure that those voices have a vision and have agency to put their vision into the world.
Well, I want to kind of bring some recent news events in Rochester to the fore, and I'm not sure they're perfect analogs, but it feels timely, because even when there is some emphasis or ostensibly a desire or an effort to be inclusive, to offer access, it often feels unequal. And I'll give you an example. The most expensive health club in town, Midtown Athletic Club, and Catherine, you're smiling across the table, you've been following this story. They just were awarded a $535,000 tax break on a $10 million expansion. They're a health club that most people cannot afford to join. That tax break, more than $500,000, still only accounts for about 5% of the total cost of the new project. They have said that with or without that tax break, the project would have gone forward. Might have been scaled back a little, 5% or so. They got it anyway. Okay. Well, now, their management points to the YMCA, and they say, look, the YMCA is supposed to be serving the community in various ways, but the YMCA is building a suburban location that's going to be bigger than Midtown out in Pittsford. They get all kinds of tax exemptions, and yes, there are YMCAs in Rochester and in Greece and in other parts of our community, but the ones in Penfield and Pittsford are the grand spectacular ones in the more suburban affluent areas. And so the YMCA counters by saying, look, that helps us support everything we do in the city, Greece, everywhere else. But if you go to the city, if you go to Greece, they are objectively not as fancy, nice, well-kept. There's nothing wrong with them. I attend them. I like them. My son and I play basketball there, and I love the staff there. I'm not denigrating at all. I'm just comparing. So even in something that's supposed to feel like it's for everybody, you go, yeah, it's for everybody-ish, but out in the suburbs, it's nicer. Here, it's not as nice. And I'm wondering if in this system that we have, it will always be like that, whether it's the YMCA, whether it's public parks and spaces, libraries, whatever the case may be, or if that is changeable within the system we have now.
It is not. No.
I mean, you don't think
no,
so?
No, I think that, you know, there's a term called that they used to say when they were looking at activists in the 60s, outside agitators. And most of the outside agitators, quote unquote, spoke about dismantling those systems. And I believe that dismantling systems that have been oppressive and that are unequal in their execution is required in order to find ways to perpetuate justice throughout the built environment. And so it does mean that we have to actively seek to extract ourselves from those particular types of systems and then find new ways to produce it. I don't know what all of those systems look like, and I'm pretty sure that they will look different in every city because of the structures and strictures that we put in place. But ultimately, it has to be about us taking down systems that are not serving the larger community in a way that they should.
So do you view your own work as making change within the current systems, even if they are inequitable, while also seeking systemic change?
Yeah, I think it runs in parallel.
It's both, we have
to, yeah, it definitely has to run in parallel. I mean, I think the only way that you can do any of these things is to dismantle from inside and outside. You actually have to change what you can and serve people now, and then recognize that dismantling systems takes a very long time, and we may not even actually see it. But we have to have those as a target moving forward.
Okay. Was my reference to the health clubs, was that fair to evoke, to bring into this conversation?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I listened to the episode last week.
Yeah, last week. Yeah.
About this. Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I think, like, one of the things that was brought up on that show was that like part of the problem is like the policy that allows organizations like that to apply for that kind of a tax break, right? And so the policy is like getting at what these structural issues that Brian is talking about and these systemic issues is like, if we have policies that allow for this sort of unequal outcome, then we have to change the policy, or we have to change the structure within the policy is set, right?
Absolutely. Nanaya, do you think systemically we're always going to have sort of that, even when there is a movement towards access for everybody, it's going to look unequal in the current system?
I am hopeful that things will change, right? But what we need to think about is that, like they said, policy dictates how we build, and how we build affects how we live. So if the policy is inequitable, we are going to have an inequitable way of life. So a perfect example is in the 90s, there was a movement called Nothing About Us Without Us. And that was done by the ADA to make sure that policies being dictated by people who were not disabled would not negatively affect them. And that movement was so powerful that now in architecture, you are not going to design anything that is not handicap accessible. So it took decades to make that effective, but it has been effective. And I think we need a movement similar to that in our field to make sure that we are trying to affect some positive change.
Well, let me get a question via email from a listener who says, Evan, some of the criticism is naive here. Some of the parks in Rochester are beautiful. Are there more beautiful parks in suburban areas? Maybe. Some of the YMCAs you're talking about might not exist without suburban locations. Wouldn't you rather have parks and YMCAs and whatever in the city at all, as long as there are others in, well, I'm trying to sort through this, others in the suburbs that can support them? Okay, so what Jim is saying is, you know, if the choice is nicer parks, nicer libraries in the suburbs, but at least you get some parks and some libraries in the cities, it's the same kind of argument that the YMCA makes, which, again, I understand maybe I'm not trying to be naive, maybe it's true, which is that you may not have YMCA locations in Rochester or Greece or whatever without the bigger, fancier ones in Penfield or Pittsford. I don't know. That's what Jim is saying here.
Yeah, but that's based on the current system as it exists. And it's
I think
like
that's what Jim is saying, yeah.
Essentially, isn't it fine to have colored-only water fountains? Even if we have the whites-only water fountains that are much nicer, it's okay. Right? Like that. The argument can't be that inequality anywhere should be okay just because the inequitable components of it are being served by the equitable components.
I think Jim is saying something is better than nothing, and people ought to embrace that.
I disagree.
And, if I can just jump in here a little bit, I will say that architecture at its finest tells a story, and the buildings have something to say. And some stories are exhilarating, stories of success, beautiful legacies, and others are quite frankly painful. And the buildings reflect that. And historically, wherever you visit, you're going to see ruins that have stories to tell. And you don't want to go to Pittsford and say, this story tells a beautiful story, and then go to a YMCA downtown and say, this building tells an ugly story, right? It should be equitable across the board. Mm-hmm.
It speaks to our value, right? Like
right.
It speaks to what we value in the society and who gets to determine whose value is more worth it. And that is always the issue that we have to deal with when we're talking about inequitable spaces.
You want to add to that, Catherine? Yeah.
I mean, I would just say, like, if we could imagine an equitable city and equitable suburbs, like an equitable city-suburb relationship, we wouldn't need this argument that we need nice things in the suburbs to support the city, mm-hmm. right? Like if we just had equity, we wouldn't need that, right? So
exactly.
This goes back to this question of sort of dismantling the system.
Yeah, and then the question becomes then how do you achieve that? And I mean, to Brian's point, there's not an easy answer in every city or even systemically. I mean, if there were an easy answer, maybe it would have been done by now. Mm-hmm. But do you feel hope that we can move in a direction where those inequities aren't so entrenched or sort of profound?
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to be optimistic about these things. I agree with Brian that I'm not sure that we'll see that in our lifetimes. But I think sometimes we have a failure of imagination. I think sometimes we're afraid of sort of radical solutions or to even like put things on the table to to think about in terms of how to create more equitable structures. And so I think, yeah, I don't know, maybe we just need to dream bigger about these things.
Okay. Mark wants to know if your out-of-town guest thinks that the word developer is a dirty word, because in this town too often it's used as a dirty word. I think developers can do projects for good, and I'd like to know if he's seen that elsewhere.
I have seen developers do projects for good. I don't place assign good or bad to developers necessarily. What I assign is a injustice in the process of development. The things developers are oftentimes just looking for a return on investment, whatever that investment may be. And if the policies require a developer to do a certain list of things in order to get that return on investment, they will do that list of things. And so either we can change the list of things that developers have to do and they will apply to that, then I think we get one step closer to being on the right side of this thing. So no, I don't think developers are bad. I think the process of development is inequitable.
Okay. Nadia, how do you think of it? What comes to mind when you hear the word developer?
I agree with Brian 100% that whatever toolkit you give to developers, they're going to milk that for whatever it's worth. And there are some who might see a value in a 2% return on investment, and some might want 20. And that is where you kind of get that gap. So again, when we go back to the idea of affordability, it all depends on what that developer is willing to live with regards to a profit margin. So I don't necessarily see them as good or bad. It's just a wide range of people with a different value proposition.
Okay. Catherine, what comes to mind when you hear the word developer?
I mean, I'm sort of steeped in the discourses here and a lot of sort of circles where people are talking about gentrification. So I think... generally, I agree there is sort of a negative association with developers here. But I agree. I think, like, again, going back to sort of ways of thinking radically, like, if there was a way to imagine development that was people-centered rather than return on investment-centered, right, like sort of an anti-capitalist kind of development, that would be the way, I think, to sort of more equitable spaces. Whether or not that is possible within the frame of how we think about development, I don't know yet.
I think you're the first person to use the word capitalism, so I'll just ask you if changed the way you would like to see it, truly equitable architecture, design, community access, and emphasis on those who do or do not have power, is that achievable in a capitalistic system?
I mean, I personally don't think that it is. I mean, capitalism thrives on the kinds of inequity that we're talking about. It needs it to produce capital, to produce profit. And it's not a people-centered political economy, right?
You agree, Brian?
Absolutely. Anti-capitalist, socialist. So yeah, I do agree. And I think, you know, if we look at just the root of our country's history, steeped in the extraction of the blood and toil of human beings to build land, to build buildings, to build our structures, capitalism was based on that and centered on that. And so I don't see any possible way for us to actually extract ourselves from that system or extract, put ourselves in the good unless we extract ourselves from that system.
Nanaya?
Absolutely. And I think capitalism thrives on the idea that if you are poor or a minority, you ought to be grateful for what we give you after we've made our profits and quote-unquote trickled it down to you. So that is something that, or an idea that needs to kind of be flipped on its head, right? That we actually earn this and we deserve this, and we're not poor because we choose to. We're poor because the system makes us poor, right? And so how do we, again, like everyone else is saying, flip that script? And I don't think capitalism is a way to solve that.
Listeners, we're not going to spend the rest of the hour on capitalism. We will have other conversations about that. But I do want to ask you, Brian, I mean, in 2019, this kind of conversation is more common in this country. Mm-hmm. Particularly interesting on sort of the political left as we go throughout the presidential primary process, because with well over a dozen candidates, there's a sort of a range of views on this. But it does seem to be the kind of conversation that is being had not – as quietly, much more in the open, much more commonly, at least challenging capitalism to do better or get off the stage entirely. Mm-hmm. That's much more common, at least from what I hear. Do you agree that at least some of that landscape has changed?
Yeah. I mean, I think the Kindle has been burning so long that we're actually in a space where we are comfortable talking about this in a much more broad way. But it is to say that we're all talking through the lens of conversations that have been being had for the last 100+ years, right? So whether it's you know, Marx or W.B. Du Bois or Booker T. Washington or Martin Luther King even, I mean, you know, once he got to the end of his timeline, he started to speak about this as well. And so I think we can look at our history and define how we want to move forward. Memory is so intimately tied to our imagination. We have to look at our past to be able to see where we're moving forward.
You're hearing Brian C. Lee Jr., a design justice advocate. He's the director of the New Orleans-based design justice nonprofit called Co-Locate, and he is in Rochester for an event today, 5:30 at Rush Reese Library. The Humanities Center has brought Brian in for a conversation, his views about, well, really, whether this kind of change can happen. Design justice, power and place is what it's called. 5:30 today at Rush Reese Library. It's free. It's open to the public. They have free parking there if you want to attend. Also with us this hour, Catherine Mariner, professor in the University of Rochester's Anthropology Department and the Visual and Cultural Studies Program. Nanaya Ando, who is an assistant professor of architecture at RIT, and he's a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. More of your feedback for our guests after our only break. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about mindfulness, meditation, Zen Buddhism, what it is, how it works in practice. And it has become increasingly popular because a new poll finds that 39% of Americans say that they have higher anxiety now than they did a year ago. What's driving that anxiety? And can mindfulness and meditation help? We explore next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm just going to keep marching right through your feedback. Emily writes to say, Evan, thank you for this conversation today. It's interesting that your guest talked about nurses, aka people on the ground who see firsthand how environments can change everything. Monroe Community Hospital was built in the 1930s as a place of last resort for sick people. Go there today and see gargoyles staring down at you outside. But inside, they have made great strides in design. Check it out. Interesting, Emily. I have not been inside that structure in a long time. Alex writes to say, so let's take the argument to its conclusion. All social environments are equal. The moral hazard of disincentive can rear its ugly head. The comparison of, quote, colored versus white water fountains is a deflection. Equal access should not be conflated with equality. More identity politics, it's about class, not race. Socialism, your guest should remember the message in Orwell's 1984. All right, Brian, are you convinced?
That was a list of... No, I'm not. I actually don't know really how to respond to that. But I will say that, you know, the idea that race is not inherent to all levels of injustice in this country really bothers me and is generally like the first set of questions we get or statements we get about our work. And I think ultimately, if we are unable to hold a mirror up and understand the inherent connection between race and class, I mean, it's not to say that class is not an issue. It is to say that in this country, we have made every bit of wealth off the back of indigenous black, brown people, black and brown people in this space. And so we have to acknowledge that if we actually want to move anything forward.
Okay. And what about disincentive, Nanaya? He says his concern is if we change systems the way the guests are advocating, that it disincentivizes a number of things and that there is an unintended consequence there.
I personally do not believe that is true, primarily because if we bring this back to the conversation of what our civic and our public spaces look like, and we try to talk about equity and equality in the same sentence, we understand that that is not true. right? Because different people don't occupy the same spaces in the same way. There are some people who are made to feel like they do not belong. So until we understand how our systems function and how they operate for different people, it is simply not going to be an equal space for all.
Okay. And Catherine, he says, equal access should not be conflated with actual equality. What do you think?
I'm not sure what is meant by that comment in particular. I think I'm a little bit confused about what he sees the difference as being between equality
and
equal
access. I'm going to take a guess here, because this is of a thread with the common critique that advocates for change are calling for equal outcomes instead of equal opportunity, and that the goal should be equal opportunity, not necessarily equal outcomes. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that equal opportunity helps move us toward equal outcomes, right? But I also think, I mean, my hackles went up when I heard, you know, the comment, this isn't about race, this is about class. Because in a way, I think that that's actually a deflection. Anytime I hear that, I get a little suspicious, particularly because of the way that those two things are deeply imbricated in American society. I don't think we can, I'm not convinced we can really disambiguate race from class for all of the reasons that Brian mentioned. And especially when we think about like the wealth gap in the United States and thinking about space in particular, there's a long history in Rochester of sort of redlining, of discriminatory lending that like actually links race to class in really specific ways on the ground in space.
Well, let me ask a question that might be from within the bubble. Mm-hmm. I grew up in sort of the Pittsford of Cleveland. I never heard the term redlining until probably my late 20s. Probably heard it on NPR when I was a WXXI member before I came to work here. Now, working within the NPR ecosystem and public radio ecosystem, I hear it all the time. What I don't know is my perception that we are getting much more honest about what we have created as an American society, what that means, how this has happened, who has been given the power and who has been denied wealth and opportunity. Are we being more honest, or am I hearing it because I'm in a certain kind of bubble in which you do hear it, but you go outside that bubble and you don't? I don't know how to evaluate that, because I'm trying to be cognizant of my own sort of bubbles, and that's difficult to do. What do you think?
I don't think we're globally being more honest. I do think that within the kind of liberal contingent of our world, we are having more conversations around this, and I think it's getting deeper. I mean, I think the idea that we've talked about redlining, but we are not, we hadn't really been talking about the set of covenants and deed restrictions and the ways in which redlining actually started to disassociate blackness from the act of oppressing blackness, right? So ultimately, if you think about the policy of redlining, it actually calls black people undesirables, right? But the procedure, the way in which it was carried out, was specific to black and brown people. And so I think our depth of knowledge is getting a little bit deeper, but I don't know that we are really talking about it outside of our circle still.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah. Let me keep working through some feedback. Andy emails the program to say, Evan, yesterday on Twitter, I noticed a discussion about country clubs and their exclusivity. I realize those clubs are private, but some of them get pretty good tax deals. Do your guests think country clubs are relevant in the discussion about accessible space? That's from Andy. Brian?
I mean, it's kind of outside of the... So I am a strong advocate of public and civic and democratic spaces. Country clubs themselves are specifically for elite individuals that have been deemed elite, let me say. I would prefer to actually have conversations that are wrapped around the ways in which all spaces are being used for the public good. So I don't know whether or not public,
Are they a negative public, or do you sort of ignore them? Do you think that they are a problem?
I more ignore them. I don't know that they would add a benefit to the communities that are currently being disenfranchised. What I do see country clubs doing is aggregating or co-locating those with wealth and privilege. And I think when we don't acknowledge what privilege looks like and the exponential value of spaces like that that actually push people into higher levels of wealth and economic kind of well-being over time, then that is a problem. But the space itself is not of interest to me.
Okay. Yeah. What comes to mind when you think country clubs, Catherine?
I mean, I think as I was listening to Brian speak, I was thinking of country clubs as engines of social reproduction. Mm-hmm. Right. So like they do aggregate wealth, power, people that we perceive mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. elite mm-hmm. In spaces where they can share resources, you know, have opportunities for mentorship, partnerships,
help each other,
right?
Make deals.
Right. Yeah. And they operate as spaces of exclusion. Mm-hmm. Right. So like at the same time that they're sort of like socially reproducing a particular kind of life way, they're keeping other people out. Of those conversations, of those resources. And so I think we should be thinking less in terms of spaces that exclude, but think more about how we can create spaces that include.
Okay. Nania, do you view country clubs as any relevant to this conversation or even worthy of consideration about their benefit or cost to society?
I hadn't really thought about it, but as a person who lives in Pittsford and I'm surrounded by three country clubs and I drive by them every day, I do think it's an opportunity for them with the resources they have to maybe invest back in the communities that they dwell in. Yes.
There's a very interesting thread, listeners, that Andy is referring to yesterday that I was following, in which a woman who is a millennial said, "I hope millennials kill country clubs." So if you want to see the responses, defending country clubs and attacking them, it was an interesting conversation. Maybe for another day on this program. Michael Kimmelman, in his story for the New York Times on the new Hunters Point Library, had this to say about government's role. And I'm curious to know what mm-hmm. Brian thinks, because Kimmelman says that throughout New York City's history, for example, when it comes to access to public space, architecture, design, different administrations have shown different emphasis, and he is really hard on de Blasio's administration. He writes, quote, "Today, New York City Hall has all but abandoned design excellence and equity. A disconnected mayor demonstrates zero interest in good design or architecture or much of anything related to the physical fabric of the city and urban planning," end quote. How important is it that leadership, whether it's Rochester, New Orleans, New York City, how much power do city governments and leadership have in changing the way we view these spaces and use these spaces?
It's extremely important for those in power to give direction because there are a tremendous amount of people in specifically New York City proper, whether it's Justin Garrett Moore, who leads is a design director for the city, Ifeoma, who are both working in the city and are exclusively working on justice and equity issues through that lens. And so the directives, though, have to come from on high. And if a mayor actually has a way of thinking that can allow for those people to have agency, the better off we will be in our cities.
Okay. Catherine, do you feel like, at least is it your sense that in our community, leadership in various levels of government, design, et cetera, are thinking about the right things when it comes to the decision making, whether it's a piece of land, say a parcel with a number on it, or like a parcel 5 or 10 or whatever, or neighborhood development, equity of opportunity, parks, et cetera, green space. Do you feel like leadership is thinking about equity?
Yeah, I mean, so there are definitely components of the new comprehensive plan that speak to equity and how to involve more residents sort of in these conversations, in these spaces of power. I think one of the things that is really important is that, yes, government officials, our elected officials, have a certain amount of power, right? But I think the important thing is to figure out how to connect them more deeply to people on the ground mm-hmm. who are living in these spaces every day, who are transforming spaces in their neighborhoods, and to give those people more of a voice to speak to power, to start to change some of the trends that we're seeing in the halls of power.
But having been at many public forums for proposed projects over the years, from the last 16 years in my coverage in Rochester, I can't tell you how many people attend those meetings, but they will say to reporters afterwards, this is just for show. They're doing this public forum. They're saying they're taking community input, and the end plan is going to be exactly what it was at the outset, but they will claim that they listened. And it is a cynical, or at least from my eyes, it feels cynical, but they might argue it's realistic, that's been the history. Mm-hmm. And I'm overgeneralizing here because I'm sure in some places you actually have charrettes like the one in Shalott a couple of winters ago or those kind of events that really do seek input that can be implemented into change. But I also understand that frustration. Do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I think power tends to want to reproduce itself, right? And so sometimes these requests for community input are exactly that, they're window dressing, right? And so I think what's important is to have people in those positions of power that see that as a trend and are actively working against it, right? And are genuine and are transparent in the way that they're collecting input from community members. And not just input at a town hall or a community meeting or something like that, but actually bringing people in to help do some of the work around this.
Brian, been around the country, how do you recognize when that call for community input is sort of genuine and how do you challenge it when it feels like it's not?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it's a community forum that's held at in a city office or a city space, oftentimes that feels exclusive. It feels as though it is centered at the seat of power as opposed to a distribution of that power. And so I am always wary of collecting people into one meeting for 2 minutes a pop where people get a chance to talk. I think what you can do and what I see across the country for those who do it well is again, a distribution of power that requires people to go into community. We always talk about the Miss Marys on the block, right? The Miss Marys are the people who in 1972 can tell you how the crack in the sidewalk happened on Main Street, right? Like the people who know every little thing about the place. We have to make sure that those people, elders and the youth who have that same capacity, are brought into the process, not just brought in and expected to give their time, but you see it done well when they are brought in, valued, and paid to be a part of the process.
I like that term, Miss Marys.
The Miss Marys.
They're so important. That's really, really good. I'm going to squeeze in as much feedback as we can. Dawn in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Dawn.
Hi, I guess I'm Miss Dawn. I live off West Main Street, and I can identify every crack in our neighborhood.
Hey.
My question is, we are seeing urban renewal down in Bullshead off of West Main, which really pretty much was destroying and demolition of all the historic buildings in that landscape and displacing the businesses and residents along the way. They've been gone for 2 years. It's been vacant. It is a brownfield, and it's been a 10-year brownfield study with the state. There's been meetings sporadic more the last couple of years. But there was a lack, like what you're saying, with the lack of an education for the population that's there about what's good design, what's good infill. You know, did demolition really need to occur on buildings just when they were structurally sound? But we were told there was asbestos in them. We know we can remediate some of those things without demolition. So my question is just, how do you define urban renewal in really, you know, struggling neighborhoods without the community's full involvement? I'm going to be pushing for a charrette down there.
Yeah.
I really think that we need to pause and have a public charrette for another 2 years, but it's going to be important to get this right now.
All right, Ms. Dawn, thank you. And we're down to our last 2 minutes, so I'll let Brian jump in here. Go ahead.
Yeah, just honestly, the idea of urban renewal has such poor connotations long term. And so thinking about our revitalization processes through the lens of reincarnation, what's the cultural and spiritual kind of space that exists in a neighborhood? And how do we actually use the envisioning of environments in a community to lift that cultural spirit? And so I think the best thing we can do is understand not just the policy, but the procedures that things are carried out at City Hall. So we understand where power sits within the process, and then to find a way to gather folks towards a vision, not just towards the acute issue.
And in our last minute, Don writes to us to say, it sounds like your guests have advocated for uniformity. If different places should be different, but they should be all equally nice, whether Joseph Avenue or in Pittsford, then isn't placemaking just changing superficial details? I don't want everywhere to be basically the same. Catherine, you mentioned placemaking. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that equity necessarily means conformity or that everything is the same, right? We're all different. Neighborhoods are different. Neighborhoods have their own unique character. Communities do too, and so do groups of people. And so I don't necessarily think that equity has to mean that everything is the same or is equally, quote unquote, nice. I think there's a lot of room for fostering uniqueness and fostering character within an environment that is equitable.
Okay. Nana, yeah, you want to hit that as well? About 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Sure. I would make the argument that there's a difference between uniform and unified, that we want to have unified architecture of something that is equitable for everyone as opposed to a uniform architecture.
Okay. Listen, if you didn't get your comments or questions in, you got a chance this afternoon, 5:30, Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. Easy to find. The parking is free. The event is free. And Brian C. Lee Jr., is going to be there for Design Justice Power in Place. He's the director of the New Orleans-based design justice nonprofit called Co-Locate, and we are grateful for the time and for spending the hour with us. Thank you for
being
here.
Thank you so much, yeah.
Great having you. And our thanks as well to Catherine Mariner from the University of Rochester. Catherine, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's do it again. Nania Ando from RIT and the Community Design Center of Rochester, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
Short break, more connections coming up.